Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem has offered a three-step plan to the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. Step one, remove the checkpoints on state and U.S. highways. Meanwhile, the governor has allowed her executive order advising Minnehaha and Lincoln County residents to stay at home if they're older than 65 or have pre-existing conditions. She's allowed that order to lapse. So do South Dakotans, especially those in the southeastern part of the state, feel comfortable going out while positive cases of COVID-19 are still being reported? And if you've actually made it out to your grocer, you've probably noticed the rising prices at the meat counter. So have South Dakota's congressional delegation members, and they want some answers. Let's bring in the Dakota Political Junkies for some discussion on those topics. First with us, Madison Daily Leader publisher John Hunter. Hey, John.
Hi, Lori.
Also joining us on the phone, Tom Dempster, former South Dakota State Senator. Tom, welcome back.
Thank you, Lori. Hi, John.
Hi, Tom.
All right, let's get started with this idea of checkpoints heading into reservation territory on U.S. and state highways. I think most people understand some of those nuances, but let's not be afraid to explain for people new to the state or haven't spent a lot of time thinking about why this matters, what's at stake here. And I want to start with Tom Dempster a little bit because there are some South Dakota legislators who spoke out about the governor's plan and had some thoughts on it as well. So what kind of background would you give a new lawmaker, newly elected to the state legislature, about this topic in general and the idea of tribal sovereignty and the lay of the land?
Boy, Lori, that's a tough question. And I think my answer would be take a very deep breath, listen, and learn. Lori, you and I both share an acquaintance, if not a friendship, with Kent Newbern, author of Neither Wolf Nor Dog. And Kent, this is back in the take a deep breath and listen and learn, Kent is going to tell us that virtually every policy dispute between South Dakota and between tribal members goes all the way back to the Fort Laramie Treaties, goes all the way back to Wounded Knee. And you have to understand that probably in order to get anywhere. Take a deep breath, listen, and learn. That means that you will be judged when you go to tribes. You will be judged on whether or not you're serious, whether or not you really care. It must come quietly. It must come as a matter of, I respect your rights. I respect your sovereignty. I respect the care and concern that you have for your people, for our people. Now can we talk?
John Hunter, with that,
does that make any sense whatsoever?
I think that just puts everything in a great frame of mind, because it's worth noting that we're, three non-native people having a conversation about what's happening in a place that I haven't driven to since the pandemic started. I know Lee Strubinger went and reported and met people in person, but so it's worth laying out the land and acknowledging that we're talking about this from a certain distance. John, tell us a little bit about how this started, because what we've seen in the Navajo Nation, for example, has been a devastating impact of COVID-19 on these people. That's the fear that could happen in South Dakota, in the reservations, in different areas. So the tribe basically said, this is one of the tools we have in our toolbox to slow people down and ask them if they're going straight through to sort of restrict some of the access. What give us a little background on what you think or what you know about what the tribes are trying to do. What's their intent with a checkpoint?
Well, I amplified what Tom was saying about the relationship among tribes and South Dakotans and lawmakers and so on. It is a complicated web of laws and so forth, where you have kind of a sovereign nation within, but yet still sharing citizenship with the United States and with South Dakota. And so we have all sorts of relationships and agreements and so on. So it's very complicated. The sovereignty of the tribal nations and the reservation system. Again, if that is respected, then tribal leaders do have a lot, if not almost all, authority over those. There are assets of other organizations, such as the state of South Dakota, United States, that cross tribal lands or are within tribal reservations. And so in this case, we're talking about state or federal highways that cross through there. So those are owned and maintained by either the state or the federal government or some combination of one providing the funds, the other one providing the maintenance and so forth. I think the tribal leaders' idea was of closing these off to prevent transmission of the virus was certainly with the best interests of tribal members at heart, right? I mean, we're all doing our best to try to prevent the virus from approaching us, and so there are places where borders and so forth that are trying to be kept. And so for the longest time, their tribal lands in South Dakota were free of the virus, and so they're basically saying, let's keep it off here. It gets a little fuzzy when you say, you know, who's going to be kept off the reservation? Does that mean tribal members only can travel here, or can non-tribal members travel across through the state if they don't get out of their vehicle? I know I'm kind of running on here, but it's a complicated issue, Laurie and Tom. And so, and then I think there are times when this discussion brings up other issues and so forth that kind of muddy the water a little bit. If we've had a disagreement about something else, sometimes that gets in there too. But I think most people are really trying to do what's in the best interest of both South Dakotans and tribal members.
Tom, one of the challenges as we look at the nuances of this is how the communication happens. And some people are saying, including Ryan Maher of, I think Irene, saying what changed? Because at one moment, Governor Noem was saying in a press conference that it was sort of hands off and that she'd been assured that everyone was being allowed to pass through. She said she got some complaints about people getting turned around and not allowed to pass through, but she wouldn't name specifics on that. And then this letter came, and some people were really taken by surprise at the letter. Do you have thoughts on the significance of how the communication has unfolded from phone calls to a public letter and some expressions of shock or surprise?
I'm going to probably take a couple minutes to answer that question, and I'm going to try and keep it to two because you're probably going to make me keep it to two anyway. but I remember some years ago when I was sitting in a tribal relations committee meeting, I was on the Senate Tribal Affairs Committee and drove up to Pine Ridge from Sioux Falls in order to attend a tribal council meeting. Representative Paul Volandra, an Indian, was sitting behind me. He was a member of the House. And the whole meeting started off when the vice chair of the tribal council started his presentation with, and these are not the exact words that he used because the exact words were a little stronger than this, but he said his presentation started with, if I could do anything I wanted to do, I would knock your blocks off. And I leaned back to my friend Paul Volandra, and I said, oh, this is great. I drive all the way out from Sioux Falls in order to hear this. And he puts his hand on my shoulders. He says, oh, settle down, Tom. He says, this is the way it always starts. He said, the Indians yell at the cowboys, and the cowboys yell at the Indians, and now we can really talk. And so I took a look at the letter. Pretty carefully. I took a look at the letter that the 16 Democrats and one Republican sent to the governor. And if you can consider the responsibility of the loyal opposition of the Democrats and a largely Republican legislature, it was a remarkable letter because it said we could have helped facilitate conversations, offer unique insight to history, culture, protocols, and vernacular. You elected, speaking to the governor, to send an ultimatum. And it said to negotiate a resolution that that there's something about the combined good of keeping its people healthy and safe. And it talked about establishing trust and showing up and putting up with cowboys yelling at Indians, Indians yelling at cowboys. I thought that was a remarkable letter that said, we are here to help you. Let us help you through this process. I thought it was remarkable.
Quick correction. Thank you to my producers. Isabel. Ryan Maher is from Isabel, South Dakota.
Okay.
I blanked
started
on that.
Started with an I.
Yeah.
I was going to correct you, Lori, but I would never be so bold.
My producers, that's what they do all day long. No, I'm just kidding.
Their first mistake in years.
Yeah, it's good to have a team. That's all I have to say. So, John, when we look at the communication, what's the way forward? Because in some ways it feels like it could be very easy to just say, oh, this is what always happens, and there's always going to be this back and forth. But there's real things at stake here, including what some of those lawmakers have said. You know, now we have to go to a federal court and spend tax dollars on this when it really didn't have to be, didn't have to go this far. As far as I know, Governor Noem still has not at this point said, you know, when a lawsuit might go forward. Where do they go from here, John?
Well, the communication is a big factor, and I concur with Tom on that kind of communication that the letter provided. And I think there's almost, there should be compulsory to over-communicate in some of these situations and to over-listen in some of these situations. I recognize the time it takes, and maybe we don't have time to do these kinds of things, but I think you need to reach out. I think everyone needs to reach out and both speak and listen in this situation. Now, specifically, you asked, where does it go from here? I think there are a number of I think, really, really good intermediaries who can sit down with the governor and the tribal presidents. One of them is her tribal secretary. There are legislators in those districts. Troy Hennard is one that who are members of both the state legislature and of a tribe in South Dakota. There are a number of great intermediaries, and I'd love to see. And, of course, it's harder today where you can't sit down in a conference room or at a coffee shop in a community and talk face-to-face in these things. It's much more difficult. I think the impersonal nature of Zoom or of that sort of thing is just hinders this process. But I'd love to see those intermediaries sit down and really help that communication.
Governor Noem issued a three-step plan to move forward. Step one was take down the checkpoints, and it occurs to me that that's maybe not something that's going to be, if she doesn't have the authority to say that in the first place, which is what the tribe is arguing here, with good reason it seems, why start there? And that gets to me to the question of intent here, Tom. And if we talk about where do we go from here, if the goal is to come up with a resolution to this particular problem, the governor would be smart to act in one way. If she has a different goal, and that goal is federal court, then you behave in a different way. So what do you think the intent here is, and how do we know going forward if it's this is the intent, or if it's a misstep in some ways?
The only answer I can give you is I don't know, Larry.
I have big questions today, Tom and John.
Yeah, I'm gonna think that the state or that the governor is looking for injunctive relief.
Is looking for what? Can you say get a little closer to your phone, Tom?
I'm gonna guess that the governor is looking for injunctive relief. Meaning take these checkpoints down. But the people that I talk to, far better versed in legal matters than am I believe that the tribe has the right to protect their citizens, just like the governor of South Dakota. Governor of South Dakota has the right to protect citizens. The answer to your question, Lori, is I do not know.
I do not know. I think that's fair. It's sometimes when you do some good listening, it's also important to every once in a while say, hey, I don't know. John Hunter, does this set us back? Does this set the governor back as far as tribal relations go? How big of a deal do you think this is, as we're in the middle of this pandemic and all of a sudden this is the top headline?
Well, I don't think it sets things back. I mean, the relationships aren't perfect, and they are probably about the same as they were. But what I do think is that we're, and I know the last 100 guests on your program, Lori, have all said the same thing, is that this is uncharted territory. And so we're moving through it, and people don't make perfect decisions, but we're having to make them on the fly, and we don't know if they're right or wrong. Maybe hindsight will say if they're right or wrong. There can be second guessing for the long time, but it's, you know, it reminds me a little bit of a situation where we've never really had a kind of a foreign war on our shores, where, you know, coming through the Midwest, let's say an army from another nation, and so you kind of make decisions as best you can at the time. Do you regret those decisions? Maybe. And how much do you want to admit you've made mistakes and so forth? I don't know that either. But again, I think if you try to keep the best interests of everyone, and to listen and to speak and to try to make good decisions, sound decisions, I think you can go a long ways. Sometimes time doesn't allow that. If something has to happen more quickly, you go, and as Tom was indicating, injunctive relief, where you want to get this thing done right away, and talking and listening for a long time won't provide that. So, but long term, I think that the relationship still needs a lot of work. I don't think this is much out of the ordinary for what the relationship normally is.
Yeah. We are going to have more with John.
Lord,
go ahead, Tom.
Maybe it's listening to my friend Paul Volandra putting his hand on my shoulder and saying, okay, now that we're done yelling at each other, now maybe we can have a real conversation.
Yeah, settle down. We're going to have more with John Hunter and Tom Debster after a quick break. We're going to talk about the easing of Governor Noem's executive order for Minnehaha County and Lincoln County. And how do people feel about going back into greater crowds at this point in the pandemic? You are on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking right now with the Dakota Political Junkies. We've got Tom Debster and John Hunter with us. Tom Debster is a former South Dakota lawmaker. John Hunter as publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. And I want to shift a little bit, John, because the national news, of course, has been opening the United States economy in some states with, much stricter lockdowns than South Dakota really ever had. Really weighing some things in the balance and trying to figure out how to do so. Here in South Dakota, different restrictions have been lifted. We're not yet at our peak, and one of the things that's changed is the governor has allowed her executive order telling folks at risk in Minnehaha and Lincoln County to expire. What happens next, John, as far as people make some of these decisions? We're looking at nice weather and some restlessness and some isolation fatigue, and yet those numbers continue to climb.
Those are all good points, but it does come back to what did the executive order mean, and did it change people's behavior? I'm certain it did to some, but I think there are others who, went ahead and mingled with other people and so on. I think the same thing happens and when it expires, and that is that I don't think people will suddenly rush and have a big party of 100 people in a small space. I just have the feeling that despite what the orders are, that South Dakotans generally are going to try to prevent the spread of this virus, that they'll continue to act pretty well. I mean, yes, we'd love our cases to be at zero, and there have been mistakes along the way, plenty of them. But I do think South Dakotans, by and large, have done their best at trying to do the things that would prevent the spread of this virus. I just have the feeling that South Dakotans are going to continue to do that until they see themselves that the numbers have come down and circumstances become such that they can mingle more.
Right. 69 new cases today. Tom, what are your thoughts? Certainly, nobody had the governor's executive order nailed to their front door as the guiding principle of how they live their day. But it does, well, does it send a message at this point?
Well, here's what happens if it does. A friend of mine, an economist, sent me a model that the Wharton University of Pennsylvania School of Business had created. It's called the Coronavirus Policy Response Simulator, Health and Economic Effects of States Reopening. And it has a bunch of different scenarios, but the two scenarios that I would focus on is where we were yesterday before we had reopenings and reopening conversations, and where we likely are. And here's what it shows. It shows a baseline in the United States where we were by the middle of July. So it says the simulator, we will have 2.7 million cases, with 150,000 deaths in the United States, and that's to July 14th. Our GDP will be down 12%, and we'll gain a week prior to the middle of January 410,000 jobs. With the removal of stay-at-home orders and a resulting change in behavior of individuals, that changes from 2.7 million cases to 5.1 million cases in the United States, and deaths of from 150,000 to 277,000. In South Dakota, and they break it down state by state, in South Dakota, where we were is we will have 15,000 cases and 266 deaths. With the change in behavior and reopening, 21,000 cases and 376 deaths. And so John hit it right. John hit the nail on the head. As citizens, free to exercise our liberty, free to make our own decisions, one takes a look at these statistics, and they are sobering indeed. And it is particularly important that if you are at risk, not to mention everybody else, that you not change your behavior. There are other sites as well. The governor of Washington, I think a couple, two, 3 days ago, focused on the RT number, the rate of explosion, as I say, or the rate of transmission. With the notion that for every person that gets infected, if he infects more than one person, you've got a geometric increase, less than one person, you've got it somewhat under control. If you can accept these numbers, and it's a site called rt.live or rt.live, South Dakota has the seventh or the eighth highest numbers in the country. That's bad news. The good news is our rate in March 24th, when this site started doing this, was 1.18. Our rate today is 0.96. But they admit that there are broad bands of uncertainty, saying that our rate in South Dakota could be anywhere between 0.7 to 1.3. And probably for me, more important than flattening the curve, more important than raw numbers of cases and deaths, is I'd love to see a public discussion of this RT number and exactly where South Dakota and Sioux Falls and other communities are. I'm going to guess that we have it.
John
If
Hunter,
I may,
yes, go ahead.
Lori, I think what, as we can now reflect on the first couple of months of what we're going through, is that especially in South Dakota, I think you see, it originally, the virus originally infected people kind of in an even manner. It was a little bit more toward population centers, so that the larger cities had more and the rural communities didn't have any. But then as it goes on and you get kind of retransmission or community spread in these things, it seems to really focus on very small geographic circumscribed circumstances. In other words, the Smithfield situation and the Good Samaritan situation both appear to be these huge kind of spikes, while, you know, Hand County doesn't have any yet. And, you know, in other parts of here, South Dakota, a few infections and they have recovered. So it went from this kind of even kind of waves lapping into your state to this these spikes. And so I think strategies need to change. And I know you've talked before, and maybe we'll talk again about lifting an order in Minnehaha and Lincoln counties for people older than 65. And that appears to be, you know, kind of these spike situations. And so I think the, you know, a general order for the entire state is not necessarily appropriate. I think more, you know, to say the people in Lemon who haven't had any, there's no cases within 100 miles in any direction, would need to be under the same circumstances as someone in northern Sioux Falls. I think they're just different, and I think it has to be, in some sense, kind of micromanaged, and that's hard to do, especially when we all want to be fair and we want to, you know, treat each other equitably. I think it needs a little bit of a micromanagement.
Yeah, and you know, as Tom is talking about this, and we've had a few doctors talk about the R-naught or the transmission number, and you take a town that's a smaller community, where people are pretty deeply connected, it could spread to a lot of people pretty quickly, or it could never come to the town, you know. And so the decisions that people are having to make about their businesses and about their nursing homes in some of those towns, how long do you ask somebody who runs a nursing home in Hot Springs to never go anywhere and remain completely locked down when you know full well that if that virus gets in, you're going to end up with those Sioux Falls numbers? People are just really making some very tough decisions.
Very important. I'm glad you brought that up, Lori. It's critical in those areas. One thing I noticed in the statistics, and the statistics are not to be entirely relied upon because we believe that there are people with the virus who don't have any symptoms and might be carrying it. We have people who seem to have symptoms and don't have it. I mean, there's all confusion. But in Lake County, where I live, there have been 5 confirmed cases. 4 have recovered. But none of them were from community spread. So you'd see circumstance where, you know, is Lake County, with their current protocols, their current practices of the people, is that appropriate? It seems like it's working with no community spread yet here. So I think you bring up a point that, you know, vulnerable populations with nursing homes, and whether it's Hot Springs or Madison or Sioux Falls and any of those, they're going to have to act differently than elementary schools are going to have to act.
Right. And colleges in the fall.
Right.
Madison, you know, would be another great example. Tourism season in places where, in the Black Hills, where many, many visitors come through. You look at these numbers and you say, were we really, really successful, or are we wrong about the actions that we're taking because they're unnecessary? And people are struggling with that. And as Tom said earlier in the segment, we don't know. The facts continue to change. We make the best decisions we can with the facts that we have. But at the end of the day, and that's what we've said in our house, you know, yeah, we're making choices that might be over, that we might look back on and say we overreacted or we were a little too cautious or whatever. But in our personal family, we have decided, because of some health conditions, that we're just going to be very devoted to these measures. And that's our choice at this point. And we also do not have the governor's executive order, you know, taped to our fridge. Before we close, indeed, I want to make sure we get to this cattle prices and the packers. And, you know, since I've started working here, early on started hearing problems and criticisms of the packers and consolidation and monopolies and price fixing and accusations. And it seems like this pandemic is laid bare those challenges even more. And now our congressional delegation is calling for Department of Justice investigations, calling for legislative changes. Take us back a little bit, Tom Dempster, to, you know, how far back does the wrestling match between producers and packers and grocers really go?
Laurie, it goes back to when Ole Rovog and his settlers came to the state of South Dakota and first settled here in the mid-1850s, 1860s, 1870s. There has always been a conversation about farmers producing commodities and they're being abused in the marketplace. That's behind that was behind George McGovern's Food for Peace program to establish a demand. That's behind subsidies and price supports for crops. And particularly, I mean, even with Senator, I shouldn't say even, with Senator Tim Johnson, I still remember him giving me instruction on the word and on what the word monopsony means. I mean, just a very few buyers or just one buyer impacting the price. I mean, the big players are supply. The big players are demand. We've got a substantial increase in supply. For because our economy is in a medically induced coma, we've got a collapse of demand. Farmers are going to suffer those collapses, and whether it be beef, whether it be pork, whether it be corn, whether it be ethanol, all of that argues that we're not at the new normal. We're at the new abnormal, and we're going to be at the new abnormal for a long time. Our congressional leaders feel certainly a responsibility to respond in some capacity, which I'm guessing that this is, but the big players are supply and demand.
John Hunter, what are some of the things we're looking forward in the days ahead? Because a press release saying they're calling for something is, a signal that they're paying attention, but what are farmers looking for to happen next? What are producers looking for to say, okay, someone's really going to pay attention to what's going on here?
I don't think we'll see a solution right away. I mean, these are structural problems that Tom has been alluding to that go way back. I think I can trigger it back to not quite 40 years ago when the Justice Department stopped enforcing antitrust legislation and allowed companies of all sorts to combine and dominate markets. An economic system works best when you have many buyers and many sellers. Right now in these commodities, we have many sellers, many farmers who produce these, and very few buyers. Then it gets skewed. The packers have indicated, look, we can be a lot more efficient and somehow convince the government to not prosecute these antitrust situations. They say we can be more efficient, we can be better, and of course it turns out that that's not. When you have very few on one side of that, it begs for regulatory control, which is what's, I think, probably the likely outcome of this. Congress and others will force they'll start controlling prices themselves. If the market can't control them correctly, then I think the government comes in, and I don't think that's always a good solution either. So, how you can get back to many buyers and many sellers? That my friend Tom Dempster might have a good solution for that.
In 30 seconds or less, Tom.
sure, John, I'm just going to concur. I'm going to concur with what you said. The Department of Justice has said for the last 40 years, if you control price, you have a monopoly. It will be really interesting in this investigation to see if they control prices.
We will leave it there. Thank you so much for your conversation today, Tom Dempster. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori. Good to be here.
John Hunter, thank you as well. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks, Tom.